This afternoon, we're going to finish off by having a look at some areas of sweeping change that may be around the corner. This session is called Future Shock. Elements of it may be shocking. I can't guarantee it, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be interesting. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first speaker. We're looking at, as I said, two areas of change. One area that will be of interest to many, many people in this room is the future of cancer treatment and the future of cancer diagnosis. Obviously, the changes in mortality connected to heart disease have been incredibly important and significant for the industries that many of you work in. Well, what's around the corner for cancer research? Well, we have with us an extremely distinguished researcher in this field. Professor Christopher Parrish has spent most of his scientific career at the John Curtin School of Medical Research, ANU, and until recently he was the director of that school. He's an immunologist and cancer biologist with a research career spanning 40 years. Chris has published over 300 scientific papers. He's recognised as a world leader in studies of how the immune system is regulated and the role of complex carbohydrates in immune cell and cancer cell behaviour. As a result of this research, he's developed several carbohydrate-based drugs that inhibit inflammation, cancer spread, and new blood vessel growth, and has developed immunotherapeutic cancer vaccines. In 2005, Chris was awarded the Clive and Vera Ramaciotti Medal for Excellence in Biomedical Research. In 2011, he was elected a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Industry, and became an honorary life member of the Australasian Society for Immunology. More centrally, he's here today to speak with us. Would you please welcome him?
Thanks, Annabelle, for the kind introduction, and I'd also like to thank the organisers of this meeting for inviting me to this conference to present to you my view on cancer immunotherapy. So I'm going to talk today about emerging trends in cancer therapeutics, but first a little bit of background. So in Australia in 2015, one in three Australians developed cancer in their lifetime, and one in four die of the disease. And so it's a major cause of death, only matched by cardiovascular disease, and similar statistics are seen in other OECD countries. But I should remind you that it wasn't always like this. From 10,000 BC to about 1820, the average life expectancy of a person on this planet was about 25 years. And that was very consistent. The archaeological record has shown this. There's really no change in any part of the world. It was only in 1820 when things changed. In fact, the statistics are even more horrendous when you look at the median life expectancy, which was 10 years from 10,000 BC to 1820. And, of course, that meant that 50% of children were dead under the age of 10. So since 1830, there have been dramatic changes in health treatment. And as you can see, that the global life expectancy now is about 60 years. And in developed countries, is around about 85 years. So what caused this? How have things changed? Well, the major change, of course, is the prevention of infectious diseases, due to three major changes in the way in which they were handled. Firstly, improved public sanitation, which has had a huge impact on the incidence of gastrointestinal infections. Vaccinations, which have made a huge difference to many diseases. Something like 50 diseases now have effective vaccines against them. But perhaps the standout is smallpox, where when people got infected with smallpox, 25 to 50% of them died of the disease. And now we have smallpox eliminated from the planet as an infectious agent. And finally, in the mid-20th century, was the introduction of antibiotics, which had a huge impact on the control of bacterial infections, which before antibiotics had a huge mortality rate. But now, of course, things have changed. Chronic non-infectious diseases are now the major cause of death, and particularly cancer and cardiovascular disease. And the exception, of course, is that there are some infectious diseases still causing problems in developing countries, which means that the global life expectancy is lower than in Western countries. And particularly HIV, malaria and tuberculosis are the three big killers in the developing world at the moment. But let's get on to the cancer itself that I'm really going to talk about today. And one question that I'm frequently asked as a cancer researcher is, why has a cancer cure been so elusive? Because you would have thought that the amount of work that's been carried out by some very clever people over a very long period, over the last 100 years, would have resulted in treatments a bit like antibiotics, which have a major impact on bacterial infections. But the major problem we face with cancer is its genetic instability. The cancer cells, by definition, are actually genetically very unstable. So when one treats them with a particular therapeutic agent, they rapidly develop drug resistance. And this has been a huge problem in developing drugs that can control cancer. In fact, cancer cells very effectively develop multi-drug resistance quite rapidly after being exposed to anti-cancer drugs, which initially look quite promising in their ability to control the disease in a patient. So how do we overcome these genetic instabilities? And the rest of my talk, I'm going to concentrate on three major areas which have been used to try and work out ways of overcoming this genetic instability of cancer cells. Now, the first one is you might say, a really obvious one, but it's also an extremely difficult one to achieve, and that is blocking processes essential for cancer cell survival and spread. Now, there are a lot of processes that are essential for cancer survival and spread, but they're also essential for normal bodily function, and so a drug that blocks that process will also kill the patient. So we have this situation where we have to develop drugs that target cancer specifically and identify unique features of cancers which sets them apart from normal tissue and can be targeted. I should also add that metastasis is a very important part of cancer, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The second approach is, if you like, coming around in a different fashion altogether, not targeting the tumour cells directly, but we now know that solid tumours require what we call a stroma around them. There's quite a contribution of host cells, non-cancerous cells, to the survival of a tumour. These, of course, are not genetically unstable, and so if we can target these stromal elements and inactivate them, we may be able to therefore stop tumour growth. And I'll give you an example of that in a moment. And finally, it's being an immunologist, I'm particularly interested in this, but it is emerging as a very exciting area, is harnessing the immune system against cancer. Well, let's deal with each of one of these individually. First, blocking essential processes for cancer survival and spread. Now, it has been known for many years now that the primary tumour isn't necessarily a death sentence. And in fact, if the primary tumour can be successfully removed without metastases or cancer spread occurring, the patient is often cured. It's quite rare that a patient dies of their primary tumour, except if it's a brain tumour. So we really need to understand metastasis and try and control that as part of our cancer therapies. And this diagram is just showing you one of the first steps in cancer spread. Cancer cells can pass through blood vessels nearby and enter the circulation directly, as depicted here, but they can also enter the lymphatics, which is a drainage system that makes sure that the fluid balance in the tissues is correct. But the lymphatics also drain into the circulatory system and release tumour cells into the circulation. Whichever route they enter the circulation by, they eventually get trapped in distant tissues, distant vessels. And this is usually because cancer cells are particularly effective at activating the coagulation cascade, and they form these microclots or microthrombi with platelets, those little yellow things stuck around them, and that allows them to lodge in a distant blood vessel. And then they have to pass through the blood vessel wall in which they've been captured. And the tumour cells go do this via three stages. Firstly, they have to adhere to the endothelial cells, or to the cells lining the blood vessel wall, pass between or through the endothelial cell barrier itself, and then pass through what's called a basement membrane, which is beneath the endothelial cells of blood vessels and keeps the vascular integrity, but also prevents small molecules or relatively small molecules passing from the circulation into tissues. And the tumour cells actually use a range of degradative enzymes to digest away the basement membrane and enter the tissue. Now, I should mention that this is a normal physiological process, this passing through blood vessel walls, that cells of the immune system use. And cancer cells have actually hijacked that process in order to spread. In fact, that's how I actually got involved in cancer research, because I was trying to work out how white cells enter inflammatory sites and realised they use the same mechanisms as cancer cells, or cancer cells use the same mechanisms as white cells. So novel developments in my laboratory, the John Curtin School of Medical Research in Canberra, is we identified an enzyme called heparinase, which is absolutely essential for tumour cells to degrade that base membrane and get through it. They can use a whole lot of proteases, which degrade the protein components of the base membrane, but there's this molecule called heparan sulfate, which is a polysaccharide, which is present in most tissues and holds them together structurally, but is also a barrier for cell migration. And this enzyme heparinase degrades that heparan sulfate and allows cells to pass through the polysaccharide barrier. Now, it turns out there's only one heparinase enzyme in the mammalian genome, so if you can target it, that's it. And the tumour cells have no other way to go to degrade this heparan sulfate. Of course, this heparinase inhibition also has anti-inflammatory activity. We can come back and discuss that later, perhaps, but side effects of these drugs are quite minimal, and I'll come back to that, why that's the case. But what we've done is actually developed a heparinase inhibitor, which is sugar-based, because heparan sulfate is a polysaccharide. And what it does is it actually blocks the enzyme's activity so that it can't degrade heparan sulfate anymore. This is the lead drug we developed, originally called PI88, which is PI stands for Progen Industries Commercial Partner. It's now given this rather awkward name of mepafostat, which is an international name given to it by international authorities, not by me. And it's a member of what's called heparan sulfate mimetic, which means that it resembles heparan sulfate. And this structure on the left there is a oligosaccharide, as we call it, of five sugars, manopentaose, or manotetraose, which is sulfated in various positions. And this actual molecule can bind to the heparinase enzyme, but it can't be degraded. So it just occupies the active site of the enzyme and prevents it working. So that's an example of this sort of approach of identifying something that's uniquely required for tumour spread. Here's a rather gruesome picture, but this is a picture of tumour metastasis of a breast cancer in a rat. And this is the lung, and those nodules there are actually secondary tumours that have formed in the lung of this rat. If we treat the rat at the time when we know the tumour cells are spreading, we can actually prevent this metastasis dramatically. And so there's virtually no tumours identified in the treated animals. And the way we think this works is that the tumour cells, we know, still lodge in the distant vessels in the presence of our drug. They still pass through the endothelial layer, but they can't get through the basement membrane. They get stuck. And the shear forces in blood vessels are very considerable. Tumour cells are quite large and aren't adapted to that sort of shear force like cells in the immune system are, and they get torn apart and destroyed. Unfortunately, this metastatic process, even normally, is very inefficient, but with our drug it's made it even less effective, fortunately. So that's an example of a unique target, and I'll come back to it a little bit later, a unique target of cancer cells that we can use to treat cancer and prevent tumour metastasis. But the next area that we can look at is also attack host components that support tumour growth, as I mentioned at the start. One area that we've been concentrating on are blood vessels. This is a vascular cast of the blood vessels within fat tissue, healthy fat tissue. The fat cells have been digested away and a resin was injected into the tissue to actually set in the vessels and so leave behind this vascular cast. And you can see that there's an extraordinary diversity or complexity of blood vessels within a healthy tissue, which is required for this tissue to survive, in terms of obtaining oxygen and nutrients and getting rid of toxic byproducts of metabolism. Now, cancers are no different to healthy tissue. They need blood vessels as well. And for a tumour to grow beyond about a millimetre or more in diameter, it needs to induce its own blood supply. This is induced by a normal physiological process triggered by hypoxia, which results in the release of a number of growth factors that stimulate growth of endothelial cells to form a new vessel. As diagrammatically shown here, they proliferate the endothelial cells, they form a new tube, and they set up a vascular supply or blood vessel supply to the tumour. So, of course, angiogenesis then represents a rather important feature of the whole growth of a tumour. It's not the tumour cells themselves, it's the host providing a vascular supply. So anti-angiogenics, of course, have considerable potential. Novel developments in the John Curtin School that allowed us to develop anti-angiogenic drugs was that we developed a test tube-based method for screening for drugs that inhibit angiogenesis. As you can imagine, it's quite difficult to work out an animal model in which we can screen for angiogenesis inhibition without horrendous numbers of animals and a very inefficient process. So it was very important that we had an in vitro screening method. And in this case, we used human blood vessels as well. We didn't have animal vessels, and these human blood vessels were obtained from human placenta. And we also, I should have mentioned just the previous slide, that the growth factors that are required to induce angiogenesis, many of them bind that same polysaccharide I mentioned before, heparan sulfate, and by a rather complicated process, the heparan sulfate is very essential for these growth factors to act. So we can also develop heparan sulfate mimetics that can interfere with angiogenesis. The test tube test that we use, the in vitro assay we use for angiogenesis, is depicted here. Here's a fragment of human placental vessel. You can see those little fibres-looking things on either side there. They're young, small vessels sprouting from the parent vessel. And these vessels, actually, the fragments, are embedded in a gel of fibrin, which is a clot. And in the presence of a clot, the severed ends of the vessel start growing new vessels very rapidly. So when we looked at inhibition of angiogenesis, here's just the control of treatment. But if we treated with some of our anti-angiogenic drugs, we could actually totally inhibit the outgrowth of new vessels. And, of course, one of the problems with this sort of assay is that when you get inhibition, you worry that is it specific? Is it due to some non-specific chemical agent that was left during the synthesis of our compounds? And we went to great lengths to show that was not the case. In fact, this inhibition was genuinely due to the drug interfering with heparan sulfate binding growth factors required for angiogenesis. And so the drug that we came up with, which is very good at inhibiting angiogenesis, is the same drug, apafostat. Now, this is not an accident. This was planned right from the start, that we were looking for a heparan sulfate mimetic that simultaneously could prevent tumour metastasis by blocking the enzyme heparinase, but also could inhibit new blood vessel growth within tumours, being anti-angiogenic. And this has the advantage that it's a treatment that is targeting multiple levels of the tumour cycle, growth cycle, so more difficult for a tumour to develop resistance to. I should mention that the number of heparan sulfate binding growth factors that this drug interferes with is probably up to almost 5 or 6. So it's not just single growth factors blocking, but several that the cancers could use to help them induce angiogenesis. So as I've summarised already, so PI88 or mapafosat represents a double hit anti-cancer drug. It inhibits blood vessel growth by starving and therefore starves the tumour of a blood supply, but it also inhibits the enzyme heparinase, which is required for cancer spread. And this drug has minimal side effects. It has some effects on the coagulation system that have to be checked, be watched carefully, but other than that, it has no side effect, and certainly the patients don't have any feelings of ill health. Quality of life is not affected at all. Stages of this drug, it goes through phase 1 clinical trials. As many of you may be aware, phase 1 clinical trials are test of safety of the drug and getting the maximum tolerated dose of the drug, initially in healthy volunteers but then in cancer patients. And since this phase 1 trial, this drug has been injected, that number's probably up to 50,000 now, doses have been given to patients, mainly cancer patients. And the most promising for phase 2 trials, we have phase 2 clinical trials where we're testing the efficacy of the drug, and it had some effect in melanoma. About 20 to 30% of melanoma patients showed some response in the sense that the tumour slowed up in its growth rate or on much rarer occasions regressed. But the most effective treatment or drug, or most effective cancer, I mean, was post-resection hepatocellular carcinoma, which is liver cancer, primary liver cancer after surgery, where there was about a 35 to 40% reduction in recurrence. I'll show you some of the data in a moment. Phase 3 clinical trial, which is the ultimate trial, a very large, double-blind, multi-centred trial, is being carried out in liver cancer and in 25 hospitals in several Asian countries. The reason it's in Asia is because primary liver cancer is more prevalent in Asia because of hepatitis B being more prevalent, and Hep B is a major oncogenic virus. And so that's the reason that the trial has been carried out in Asia, where there's more of these cancer patients, primary liver cancer. Now, this is some of the phase two data showing the effects of PI88 on the survival of patients, or the proportion of disease-free patients. With hepatocellular carcinoma, the major treatment is surgery, removing the primary tumour from the liver. There's currently no widely accepted chemotherapeutic approach. So what happens is in the next 12 months, usually 50% of patients get recurrent disease, and within 3 years they die. And so the prognosis is quite poor. The blue line there is in this our own trial, the control group, which received a saline injection rather than the PI88. You can see by 50 weeks they had pretty well, almost 50% of them had recurrent disease. PI88 treatment, incidentally, was started at 5 weeks after surgery, and for 30 weeks they received the treatment, and then the treatment was stopped. You can see with the PI88 plot, the green one, it's diverging from the control quite substantially, so that there are much fewer patients that are getting recurrent disease in the first 12 months after surgery. So that was a very encouraging result, which has stimulated the phase 3 clinical trial. Okay, let's go on to the final part of my talk, which is harnessing the immune system against cancer, which is dear to my heart being an immunologist. Now, by harnessing the immune system against cancer, I mean cancer immunotherapy. And this means treating patients who have already got cancer with a cancer immunotherapeutic agent, not a classic vaccine. I'll come back to the sort of prophylactic vaccines in my summary at the end, but where you immunise or vaccinate a person against a virus like human papillomavirus, which causes cervical cancer. In this case, we're trying to reinvigorate the immune response within a patient who's already got cancer. It's been very controversial over the last 100 years as to whether the immune system really plays any role in controlling cancer at all. And for probably 50 years ago, the general consensus amongst immunologists was that it did not play a role. But since then, the evidence has been coming overwhelming that, in fact, many cancers, there is an immune response against the tumour that has an effect on the tumour's survival. And in fact, it's now been hypothesised, based on quite a lot of very elegant animal experiments, that there's a process of cancer immunoediting occurs during cancer development. On the left-hand panel there is the first stage. Many tumours arise in individuals which are eliminated by the immune system without us even knowing about it. So that occurs, we believe, quite frequently. Then there are situations where there's an equilibrium, where the rate of the immune system killing cancer cells is similar to the rate of tumour growth, and so the equilibrium state is created. And you can imagine an equilibrium like that, anything that changes the balance very rapidly results in escape, particularly with the genetic instability of cancers, where the immune system is in effect selecting, in the classic Darwinian sense, for tumour cells that can evade its recognition and killing. So the escape occurs on the right-hand side there, and that's when the tumour actually presents itself to the oncologist. So when an oncologist sees a patient with a cancer, normally that tumour has been growing for many years and has had a long time to actually evade the patient's own immune system. So the real challenge for an immunologist is to try and turn this around and reinvigorate the immune system against the cancer. So how do we do that? What approaches we've got? Well, I'm just going to outline three of the approaches, some that my laboratory has been involved in. The first is immunising against tumour-specific antigens. Now, that's a fancy term, but tumours do express proteins that are different from self because they're so genetically unstable, they're mutating proteins. So these mutant proteins can be seen by the patient's immune system as foreign and responded to. There are also certain molecules that are expressed in the wrong place that are not normally expressed in tissues, and so our immune system isn't very tolerant of them and so can respond to those as well. But this approach is hard as tumours are heterogeneous, so it's difficult to develop a universal vaccine, almost impossible. But certainly cancer type specific vaccines are possible, and my group has been doing that. And the approach we've used is targeting our vaccine to a very important cell called the dendritic cell, which immunologists have discovered some decades ago, which is the master regulator of immunity. These dendritic cells, which are not that prevalent, probably only 1 or 0.5% of white cells in lymphoid tissue, these cells have a remarkable ability to identify pathogens. They have a whole array of receptors on their surface that can recognise unique molecular patterns expressed by pathogens, be activated by those receptors, and then present to T cells, which are lymphocytes that can respond and produce lymphocytes that can actually recognise the tumour and destroy it. These T cells can then be activated and expanded to respond to the tumour. Now, we have this difficulty that these dendritic cells are also maintaining tolerance to self proteins, so our immune system doesn't get out of control there. So it's a tricky tightrope arrangement, but we are able to get around it by various tricks. And our vaccine is called Lifovaxin, which is a combination on the left of the figure of membrane vesicles from a tumour. On the right, we have liposomes, which are artificial lipid membranous sacs, which we can actually use to deliver to the tumour membrane vesicles a molecular glue, which allows us to stick onto the surface of our vaccine proteins that target our vaccine to dendritic cells. And we also in the middle include interferon gamma as an example of a hormone of the immune system which is known to activate dendritic cells and make them much more effective at inducing an immune response. And here's just a picture of what happens. This is not to scale. The Lifovaxin particles are a thousandth the size of a dendritic cell, but they target a particular molecule called DC-cyan in this particular experimental system, but we're still perfecting what's the best targeting molecule to use to target dendritic cells. But we've already tried this vaccine out in phase one clinical trial in cancer patients, in melanoma patients, and it's very well tolerated and showed some signs of efficacy. But we still think we can do better by getting a better targeting molecule and also by improving the contents of the membrane vesicles that we fuse into our vaccine. But that's an example. It's probably one of the most sophisticated vaccines that's ever been made, actually, in terms of the components that are required. But we've worked out how to do it, and it looks as though it could be a very effective vaccine, not only for cancer, but also for other diseases like tuberculosis. The second area I'd like to touch on is work that other groups are doing is for removing the brakes from the immune system using checkpoint inhibitors or interfering with checkpoint inhibitors. Now, it's been known for some time now that the immune system has feedback loops which stop it getting out of control and causing immunopathology when it gets too effective at clearing a pathogen. Unfortunately, due to the remarkable Darwinian selection of cancer cells, they develop ways in which they can activate the brakes on the immune system or induce brakes on the immune system and shut down immunity against them. So two molecules called CTLA-4 and PD-1 have been identified, which are key negative regulators of the immune response. If you make antibodies to them, you can block their action, and so the immune system is reactivated in a totally non-specific way to respond to the cancer. There are safety issues with this approach. As you can imagine, there's a risk of autoimmunity, but nevertheless, there has been quite a amount of success. And in melanoma, there's been about a 70% response rate to PD-1 particularly, and about a 30% extension of life with this approach. So these checkpoint inhibitors are a hot area of cancer immunotherapy at the moment. And being more targeted and more selective, they could be even better than what's available at present. Now, I've skipped that slide in the name of time. So the final area I'd like to talk about is the changing the tumour microenvironment, because the tumour microenvironment is definitely immunosuppressive, and also bypassing T-cell immunity altogether. We don't have to worry about identifying mutated proteins that the tumour carries that we immunise against. We actually target what are called innate immune cells, which T cells bring into tissues and clean up infectious agents. The cells are called neutrophils, eosinophils, macrophages. They're pulled into tissues and carry out the elimination of pathogens. T cells themselves can't do it unless they can kill the virally infected cell. They actually rely on these innate immune cells to be pulled in to the tissue to carry out these very non-specific processes of killing pathogens and cells, say protozoa or worms and other pathogens like that. So we're planning to get, we are in the process of developing this universal cancer immunotherapy that, it describes it in a bit more detail in the next slide, which consists of Firstly, a way of targeting our tumours selectively, and we're using liposomes, the same approach we use for our liposaxin, and we have ways of actually targeting those liposomes selectively to tumours. I can't talk about the molecules involved at the moment because of IP issues, but I can tell you that we can do it. And we also can induce this innate immune response, attract in some of these innate immune cells, like eosinophils in particular, the one that we go for. This is a one particular type of white cell which is produces very toxic proteins. It actually can be induced to explode a bit like a suicide bomber in, within the tumour. And so it's very difficult for tumour cells to evade this sort of attack because these toxic contents are thrown out around neighbouring cancer cells and cause them to die. The normal function of these eosinophils is to actually get rid of extracellular parasites in the gut particularly. But we're inducing that sort of response within the tumour. And in fact, the other clinical situation where eosinophils cause problems are in chronic asthma, where they can infiltrate the lung and cause some damage. So we're essentially inducing chronic asthma attack within the tumours. Now, the effects we get with this approach can be quite dramatic. This is a proof of principle experiment. This is a pretty gross experiment, but this is where we've got melanoma that has metastasized in the mouse to its lung, and this black because of all the melanin being produced by the tumour. If we attract eosinophils into the tumour, we can get dramatic reduction in the number of tumours within the... And this is treating the animals after they've already got metastases. We can get very dramatic reduction in tumours within the within the lung. Quite spectacular. So I think the proof of principle is there. This tumour regression occurs within 48 to 72 hours of administration of our treatment. So finally, cancer in the 21st century. There'll be a reduction in cancer incidence due to prophylactic vaccines, as I mentioned earlier. And also, of course, lifestyle changes, which I haven't really talked about at all today, but smoking causes about 20% of cancers in the moment. Diet's another possibility, and the obesity epidemic, there's no doubt that obesity increases cancer susceptibility. I'll quickly go through these two other areas, but I think that there will be a cocktail of subtle anti-cancer drugs with minimal side effects that control but not necessarily cure cancer, a bit like insulin for type 1 diabetics or antiretroviral drugs for HIV sufferers. And also harnessing the immune system against cancer, I think, is the dark horse. It has a potential, I think, to have massive impact and could be the way to go in the near future as a preferred method of treatment. So I've just put this slide up to show you the very large number of collaborators involved in the work I've talked about, which has been over 20 to 30 years, some of it. Progen Pharmaceuticals and Lipotech have been commercial partners. NHMRC and New South Wales Cancer Council have also been important sources of funding, particularly at the early stages of the work. So thank you for your attention.